Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, August 3rd, 2002. Today's session is entitled Letters from the Earth, Connecting with the Earth as Mystery, presented by Norm Hubble, and it's number HAN 2002-05. Let's listen in.
As time goes on, you know, we begin to realize that even in Western thought, Western thinking, that separation got worse and worse. So that the world of heaven, or the world of humans, was seen as superior.
He's waiting for you to say, turn on the tape, are you ready?
We will begin now. The master speaketh here. I have never had to do that before. I don't know, my presence has always just been enough. Anyway, now that Dan is here, I have to confess, because Dan's Bible studies have been wonderful, so I've been writing a little song in honor of Dan Fairlander. And you bring your guitar?
No.
No, anyway, it doesn't matter. We'll hopefully have it available a bit later. It is called The Way of the Wilderness. Huh? And it's to the ash grove, you know. I'll just sing a little bit. This is in honor of Dan. A voice in the wilderness calls us to gather, to come and discover the wilderness way. To love life like manna and share all together, embracing the call of the wilderness way. A way of forgiveness, releasing the spirit, to heal all the broken in body and soul. Resisting the grip of a world craving power, we're free to join Christ in the wilderness way. Thank you, Dan. Now, if the tape is on, we will continue. And so I wrote some letters and a little piece of that one letter is on the board. And if somebody, did anybody else write a letter last? If you do, please give it to me. And what I want to emphasize today as we move through three texts is that we've had God and heaven there, but we've also had, we always called it man, and earth and nature below. And in Western thought, because man was thought to have a mind or a reason, human beings were also thought to be very definitely superior to Earth. And so if I were to be a scientist, I could be a scientist because I could be detached, I had a reason, like the rest of creation does not have such a reason, and I could analyze. And that gap was there. That gap between human beings and the rest of the natural world. And to some extent, scientists today, quite a number of scientists today, are beginning to recognize that the world that they're analyzing is a world of mystery. And the degree of mystery is just unlimited. But historically in Western thought, we have carefully divided humans and God, and that's the superior spiritual world. Humans are superior. They're rational and they can think and analyze and they can be scientists, and Earth is that which is analyzed, seen to be the object of our investigation and all the rest of it. Now, I want to focus today on three texts which emphasize the concept of mystery. Some wonderful science books now about the mystery of the universe and the mystery of the elements and the mystery of everything. And the more I study ecology, and I'm not an ecologist, the more I'm absolutely amazed. And I take a flower like this one here and I look at it and I say something amazing about that flower. If I analyze it very closely, I'll discover that that flower is not the same as that flower. Each one is a little different. Each one's got a slight variation, a minute variation from the other. And yet somehow, there's some kind of code, some kind of mysterious impulse inside this plant, so that this flower knows to be a flower that shape and that color. Or a bird knows to be that shape and that color and with that voice. And the more I study that mysterious inner impulse, the more I'm absolutely amazed. You can call it DNA code, you can call it what you like, but there's that inner impulse, that inner code, that mysterious code within, that somehow or another enables that flower to be a flower. It might not be a mind that we have, but it's something. How does it do it? It's absolutely magnificent. I'm interested in that mysterious inner impulse, that mysterious inner code. And I want to look at three texts which focus on the mystery. And I want to look at three texts, one of which we talked about yesterday, but I'll look at it again to some extent because people are, some of you are new. And I'll look at a new aspect of it. This is a bit awkward because I've got a bad arm and I'm getting hot. I want to look at three texts, and each of these will emphasize God's relationship to Earth. The first one is basically God, and I didn't say this yesterday, but I want to wait for it today. God as someone who helps give birth. What do we call that?
Midwife.
Right. So the first one is basically God as a midwife. The second one, text is God as a dancing designer. And the third one is God as scientist. Now, these three texts, the first one is fairly easy. The second one, we have to do a little bit of careful thinking. I want to revise what we did yesterday and see whether or not it's clear why it's so extraordinary that that first chapter of Genesis is really very different than what we've ever said before. For those of you who are new, we're not just asking the question, what does God say? Or what is God doing? We're not just asking the question of where Earth, where humans are and what humans are doing. We're asking a question, what about Earth as a key character in the story? Earth as a character. Earth as a being in the story. And I want you to look for a moment again at Genesis 1 verse 2. The creation of the world starts, the creation process starts in Genesis in the first day. And the first day is verse 3. So we now have a picture. We want to, just for the moment, revise our memory of the picture of the way things are before God goes to work. Now, I want to remind you, this is not a story necessarily about creating anything out of nothing at all. It's not a story about creation out of nothing. It's quite a different story. Now, in Genesis 1 verse 2, the story starts by identifying the main character. Who is it?
Earth.
And it says, Earth was. It's going to describe to you what Earth was. Earth was. And for the sake of our image here, something like, well, an embryo. Here is it's all water. And water is everywhere. And Earth is in the water. And through the water, there's a wind blowing. That's the wind. Here's Earth. And here's the water. And all of that is in total darkness. So what you have to do, what I did yesterday, you can't see that. Right? You can't see it. It tells you what's there, but you can't see it. It's a very clever beginning to the story. The story tells you what is there. Earth in water, in darkness. Which is like a womb. Isn't it? Exactly. Now, that earth that's in darkness, in water, if I'm going to ever see it, the first thing I need is light. So the first day of creation is, let there be light. Otherwise we can't see what we're wanting to see. What's going to happen? The creation of light is the, like God's saying, lights, camera, action. It's the beginning. Opens the door, opens possibilities. So God says light, and light appears. Now, it's not the sun and the moon, because they don't come till day four. So what is it, and how this light appears, and where it is, I don't know. Is it like a little neon light in here? Or is it lightning? We don't know. It's just this mysterious light that's there. But it does let you say, see what's going to happen. Doesn't it? Fascinating. Then the second day, God says, well, I've also got to be able to see it because there's too much flame and water around. Right? Get rid of some of this flame and water, otherwise I'll never see it when it comes, when it's born. So then God says on the second day, let there be what?
A dome
on the top to keep the water on top from the water below. So now we've got a little space in which for the birth to happen. Space for the earth to appear, to come. And we talked about this yesterday. But now, for those of you who weren't here, I want to focus on precisely this moment. Here's the water, and suddenly what happens? It's important to recognize the text does not say, let there be earth, as though it were not there. It's there, so you can't say, let there be earth. It's already there, isn't it? So what do you say? It says quite explicitly, let the earth appear. Let the earth appear. Let it come out of the waters. And in my purple puzzle tree, it's a hump, a bumpy lump. It comes out of the waters, right? So earth appears out of the water and is seen. Now the first focus on this being mystery is first the mystery that it's always been there in the water, second the mystery that it's born, and third the mystery that this appearing, the word in Hebrew for that, the word appear, is the same word that's used when God appears, when God is revealed. We talk about a theophany. That is the manifestation of God. And in order to capture that, I've spoken about a geophany. That is a revelation of earth, an appearance of earth from out of the deep darkness of the waters to be and to exist and be seen. So the mystery of earth's beginning. In other words, this text tells us a story about a mysterious beginning of this thing that was mysteriously hidden in the waters. It's images that help to highlight the mystery dimension, the wonder dimension of it all. Not zap, God says, let there be earth, and there was earth. No. I want earth to appear out of the waters. And God is, I would suggest, something like a midwife enabling this to happen. I pause for one moment. Am I clear? Okay. Now, the next thing that happens that highlights the mystery of earth is God doesn't say, let there be trees. God says, let the earth bring forth trees and plants. All of it's in earth. God doesn't put it on earth. It emerges from earth. God evokes and emerges and brings out all of life from earth or the waters around earth. You follow? So earth, the whole concept of, we might have had of Mother Earth is perfectly good concept. It doesn't use the word mother, but basically the same idea is there, that earth gives birth to. God is the midwife for birth, and then earth in turn gives birth. All these things are born out of earth. The trees and the seeds and everything. Not inconsistent with evolution, as far as that goes. Mm-hmm. If you want to make that connection. Now, on the fourth day, God says, the waters can do their bit, so the fish come out of the waters. The birds come out of the sky. God never says, let there be, excepting on the fourth day when he says, well, there needs to be a sun up here and a moon up here. And what's their function? Their function is not just to be there. Their function is to be seasons and to provide light for earth. Earth is the central character of the story all the way through. It's a story about this mysterious thing called planet Earth. And Earth means all of that, the physical universe. And the sixth day, which I didn't notice until I was, 55 or 60, I don't think. Out of the earth also come the animals. Animals also come out of the earth. The frogs, everything. It all emerges from earth. In a remarkable way, which we've never really thought about. But earth is the source of life, the source of all things, and the mother, if you like to use that term. Certainly the parent of all life. In a sense, also humans. That's very clear in chapter 2, that humans too come from earth. And time again, the Old Testament says, you came from earth and you returned to earth. Job says, I was out of my mother's, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will return there. That means earth, not really, not a personal one. So the first of these portraits of mystery is one that we actually touched on yesterday and highlights the mystery of both God's relationship to earth, but earth as a mysterious, extraordinary thing that is revealed from the deep waters and then is itself the source of life for everything. Comments? Thoughts? How have you read it? I mean, I read it to say, originally God said, it was like zap, 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 God was a general and gave orders, and all these things got created in a row. That's not the way the text has it at all. It isn't a series of commands from on high. And how all I, people say, oh, there are 10 words, God says, and zap, everything happens. That's not the way the story runs at all. When God speaks, it might be an invitation to earth to produce something, or an invitation to the sea. It's not a series of commands like the 10 commands that. And some scholars have led us quite astray because they've read the text in the light of John 1 or something and not read it on its own terms. Question?
I agree with you. I agree with what you're saying. What do you do with verse 1 in the beginning when God created?
All right, we touched on that yesterday. In the beginning, this is the title.
Mm-hmm. That's baseball.
It's the title, it's the superscription for the whole thing.
Okay.
And the conclusion of this thing is what we call an inclusio, a nice pattern where you have an opening and a closing which surround the thing. Mm-hmm. And if you go to 2 verse 1, which is the end of it, so the heavens and the earth were finished, right? And everything that's in them. Mm-hmm. But what I pointed out yesterday is that the title really shouldn't say, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. It should be the skies and earth. It has, because the moment you say heaven, you think about God's domain and angels and all that sort of stuff. The word for sky there, is the same as the word for this here. So verse, chapter, day 2, when God creates the sky, that's the same word as in the title of the superscription. So it should say, in the beginning God creates the sky and the land of sky and the earth. It's about the physical universe, not about God's domain. Because where is God in the story? Not in heaven. but blowing through the water. The wind of God's blowing in the water. God's in the middle of the darkness. God's in the dark, so God says, I've got to have some light. You've got God in the darkness at the very beginning. And so the superscription, I believe, should read skies in it. And therefore it's nothing to do with heaven as a domain of God whatsoever. Okay? That's a good question. Thank you. Any other thoughts or reflections? Yeah.
I was thinking that the people at this time would think the earth was flat. There is no sense of a round earth. So
that's right. That, their perception is, my understanding is, the earth is flat. There's water here. It's got a few bumps on it, even if it is flat, you know. They know there are mountains. And then it goes over here. And the sky is like a dome.
Yeah.
That rests on either end of the earth.
Okay.
And there's a common expression all the way through the Old Testament where it says that this earth is resting on some foundations. Now, whether they're foundations like our understanding of foundations, I don't know. But, you know, the foundations, God starts off to Job. He says, were you there when I laid the foundations of earth? It never says, when I created earth. It always talks about how God did with earth. It's always there. That's the remarkable thing. It's not an image of the world. Yes, the world was essentially flat. Yeah. But how far you could go before you reached and hit the sky. What was that movie where they were, they were enclosed?
Yeah. Tom Hanks.
Yes, Hanks.
Yeah.
You know, it's Tom.
Huh? He was enclosed in an island.
Jim Carrey. Yeah.
Jim Carrey. In a movie where he was.
Yeah.
He finally hit the wall.
The Truman Show.
Yeah, the Truman Show, right. The Truman Show. Right. It's like the Truman Show. The idea is, well, you're not quite sure when you hit here what will happen. And he hits the wall. Mm-hmm. He hits the sky, as it were. And he was in one of those flat earth pictures. All right, so you're right. The portrait is of a limited cosmology, but it's not. There's a sense in which this is a mysterious and wondrous cosmology, like a portrait of the Earth, you see, with Earth being far more than what we've tended to make it, a mysterious source of life which God has given birth to, as it were, or been midwife to at the beginning. Anything else?
Well, I think in the Hebrew mind, too, the firmament is holding back water.
Absolutely.
So
this is a solid thing. A solid sky is solid, in some sense. And when the flood happens, you have all these waters below come up, and the windows open, and these waters come down. And the flood is a return to the waters of chaos, the waters of the beginning. And then, once again, God has to redo it. And the dry land, the earth, appears out of the water after the flood on which day? New Year's Day, marking a new beginning. Chapter 8. So, yes, the picture is different. And it's a little different from one place to another in the Old Testament. It's not all identical. Different images of the cosmos in different places. Any other?
It says a wind from God. It doesn't say God is the wind.
The Hebrew is. It's a problem of knowing the Hebrew, you know. Ruach Elohim. Literally, that can be translated either wind of God or spirit of God. There's no from. That's a very natural translation. There's no from in there in Hebrew. If there was from, I'd have to have another thing, another lesson. It's either the wind of God or the spirit of God. And many would say wind is preferable in this text because it's the natural portrait of the way things work. And I would agree. But the same word for wind and spirit in Hebrew. Same word. All right, any other questions? Now, this is a text which is familiar to you and I hope has now a little bit new insights into its force and meaning. Questions? Before I erase this brilliant diagram.
How does this compare to the Australian Aboriginal creation?
If you come on Tuesday, I'll tell you. But we have, there's a little book in the, Aboriginal Australia, there's something like 500 different nations. Like you've got lots, Navajos and whatever. We've got lots. So there's a great diversity of creation stories across the country. From the north, in the seas, to down south, desert, many different stories. And we have a little book in the library, in the bookstore, where I work with a group of Aborigines from Queensland, and they did a book, did a theology, where they try to connect their theology, their understanding of reality, with Christianity. It's called Rainbow Spirit Theology. That's worth looking at. And there's also a book there called The Rainbow Spirit in Creation. How would they understand this story from the point of view of where they are? And they understood, and this actually helped me, because when they think about it, the creator spirit for them is not a wind like it is in this story, but is a rainbow snake. And the rainbow snake is in the middle of Earth. And the creator power is always in Earth, and Earth is eternal. And then life forces come out from Earth, much the same way it does in this story. Earth is a source of life, and life forces and spiritual forces, not just physical forces, but spiritual forces. And they emerge from Earth, or if you're on a seashore, sometimes a sea. And we could go on for 3 days on this, but that's essentially the key point. And the portraits in that little book in the bookstore show how an Aboriginal elder from this group would read Genesis 1. It's fascinating. And when the light comes, let there be light, the rainbow snake sends out lightning from the center. It's beautiful. I never thought about that before. All right, now I need to go to two more texts. Can I erase? That's the first portrait of mystery. The second portrait of mystery is a text which you may or may not have read at all in any detail, but it's a very important text in it's Proverbs 8. And I want you to turn to Proverbs 8:22. It's a story about another dimension of mystery, of creation. But before we actually read that text, I want to discuss one word in the Old Testament which ties in exactly with what Dan's been doing. It's the word for way. It's a Hebrew word called way. In Hebrew it's derek. Now sometimes way just means any old way, you know, the way down the road, the way up home, the way, it's a very common word. The way to town, the way people go. But the word way also has another special meaning in what we call the wisdom literature. The wisdom literature are those books, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Job, is a set of books that reflect the wise men, usually, of the Old Testament period. They had wise men in Babylon and Egypt, and they fertilized and sent ideas across. The wise were the cosmopolitans of the world. If you were one of the wise, it didn't matter whether you believed in that religion or that. You still could talk about your wisdom with somebody. And so you have a lot of cross-fertilization of wisdom ideas all around the ancient world. They were the scientists of the ancient world. They observed nature. And they observe nature and try and understand it and understand laws of life that corresponded to the laws of nature. And you read them all and you'll discover all those sort of things. Now I'll give you just one. There are dozens of these, but one of the most fascinating ones is in Proverbs 6, verse 6. And it will illustrate my point without going to read a whole lot of text. Okay, now I'll read my translation. You can follow in yours. Just a couple of verses. Verse 6 says, go to the ant, you lazy bone. Used to be, in the old English, it used to be sluggard. I love that. Go to the ant thou sluggard.
NIV says
sluggard. It's got sluggard. It's gone back to the old language. That's great.
King James does too.
King James was sluggard. Yes, I know. I learned the word sluggard from old King James. Now, go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider its way, or ways, and be
wise.
So if you understand the way of something, you can become wise. Now, what's the way of an ant that's unusual? It's very much a Dan Earlander book. Without any chief, or officer, or ruler, it prepares its food in summer, gathers its sustenance in harvest. How long will you lie there, old lazy bones? It's an extraordinary text. Now, what I could talk about being lazy, but I'm not more interested in this word here. He says, go to the ant and consider its way. A lot of other texts talk about the same thing. There's a famous one. Three things are too wise for me. The way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a snake on a rock, and a couple of others. Now, what is the way? It's not a road. How would you, reading that text, say the word? What the word way means?
It's practice.
Habit?
Industrious.
Huh?
Industrious.
Yeah, that's what it does. That's the outcome of its being. It's nature. All right, it's nature. That's a good close one. It's nature. What's the... And I would expand that just a little bit to say it's inner characteristic. That which is characteristic of an ant is this. There's something in an ant, it's antness. The antness of ants is to do this. An ant doesn't go and rule and conquer like kings do. An ant doesn't go and roar like a tiger. An ant does ant things. Right? So, it's not funny, it's actually very important. Ants, the way, is the inner characteristic of something. And in the modern corresponding thing in science would probably be, say, that's its code. The code of something. That's what would be the modern equivalent in my thinking. Because it has this code, it does these things. Because you have that code, you're not like that, right? Whatever it is that you do that is part of your inner characteristic, your inner code. So the word way, for me, is a crucial word for understanding the next texts, the next two texts that we're going to look at. You need to know there's something to do with the characteristic, the fundamental characteristic of something. So, keep that one in your head. If I can find the rest of it. Now I want you to turn to Proverbs 8. Proverbs 8:22. And I want to put a translation up on the board because it will be slightly different to yours, and because yours probably has done the most devious thing, and that is eliminate that word way from the text. It's just amazing. I have not found a translation yet that preserves the word way, which is in that text. My translation is this. Yahweh acquired me at the beginning. All right. His, as it is masculine here, way before his works. Look at that translation. Look what's happened to yours. You have eliminated the word way, I'll bet, in your translation. Might have a footnote saying way in Hebrew.
Yeah, Hebrew way.
Hebrew way. Well, why don't put it in there if it's there? Now, the point I'm making is this is crucial. Now, you can translate this three different ways here. You can say God acquired me, God
brought me forth,
begot me or brought me forth, or God created me. There are three different ways that people translate that word. The thing is that the word, which is, you learn another bit of Hebrew, the word kana, every other time that occurs in Proverbs, is always translated acquire. Every other time that occurs, yes?
I'm lost. What verse are we on?
22, 822.
822.
I'm sorry, 822. You've got to get back on the way, then. 822. So, it doesn't matter for the sake of my argument and what I want to show you about this mystery. It doesn't matter whether you translate it one or the other. For the time being, the important thing is that before God does any of his work, his works, before God does any of his works, there is a way that God is using. And what do we think a way was?
Nature.
In the nature of things. A code, a design. God is using some code or design at the beginning, from the beginning. And it's this code or design that's speaking. And the code or design is portrayed. What is the name of this code or design? Wisdom. In Greek we say Sophia. Hebrew is Chokhmah, isn't it? So wisdom is not simply something in your head. It's something that's going to be the code for things, the design for things, that's there from the beginning. In other words, God has used this thing called wisdom, this way, in ordering the world. And the way, that way, is the code, as it were, and I would say for the sake to make it clearer, it's the code of God. It's the wisdom that is there that tells you and it reveals all the things that is true about Earth. Now just read a few of these verses. This code, this wisdom, and wisdom is here speaking. Wisdom is speaking. God created me, first of all, way before the work. On the right part here. And then it goes on. When there were no deeps, when there was no water yet, and there were no springs, I was there. The code precedes everything. This mysterious code called wisdom precedes everything. No springs, when there'd been no mountains yet shaped. But see, the code is part of it, is there from the beginning. And when God had not yet made earth, the land that is, and the fields, or the earth, the first bits of soil, when he established the skies, I was there. The code is there from, and through it all, and as part of it all. And it goes on, verse 29, when God, he assigned the seas its limits, so the waters wouldn't go beyond it. When he marked out the foundations of the earth, there they are again. I was beside him. God had beside him this code, this design, portrayed here as a designer. Like, now, then comes the question. How do you translate it? Verse 30. You've got a word that occurs only twice in the Bible. And we have great difficulty saying, what does it mean? What does your translation say? I was beside him like a
master worker.
Like a craftsman. Has somebody got something else?
It says another reading is little child.
Yes. Mm. So you've got this, yes.
No sense at all.
Yes, and people say, oh, couldn't possibly be a little child. But if this is the beginning, this is the birth of everything, this picture of this code, this mysterious code, you've got two chances. Either you can have it as a craftsman, or you can have it as a child. And God has this infant code, this infinite beginning of things. I like the child translation, but it's highly debated. And you can flip a coin on this one. Scholars will never be decisive, I don't think. I happen to like it. What's more important, that image, is that this is the code of creation that God is using. It's part of the design of things. And it's treated like personal. It's a personal thing going on when God creates. It's not an impersonal act. And then, what on earth does God do in relationship to this great, fascinating child? And I was his delight, rejoicing, dancing before him always. So you've got God dancing. The Lord of the Dance is a great song, because in fact this reflects the whole image of the Lord of the Dance. God celebrating and rejoicing with this mysterious code, symbol, child, design, all colorfully portraying the great mystery of the cosmic order, cosmic design that God has effected. Fascinating. I know it's a little complex, but it's also very profound. Because it doesn't portray God the Creator as the general again who says zap, zap, zap. It's God who is the artist, using this artistic blueprint, if you like, which is also portrayed as speaking to God and speaking about being there and rejoicing and dancing with God until the final line. It says, and rejoicing in the world and delighting in the human race as well. So this sense of the Lord of the Dance, God the artist. Maybe dancing the artist is better than designers, it's a little bit more colorful. But that you understand the portrait that's going on here? Just briefly. Yeah.
Many years back, I worked with a dancer who spoke this text and danced it.
Oh, great.
I played music behind it. It was really wonderful.
Want to get your guitar?
You want to dance?
You'll sing.
I'm not going to dance. That's other comments about this?
Ephesians 2:10 also says we are God's work of art or something.
Yes. That's right, Ephesians 2:10. And you've got other places which use the language of art, which I'm highlighting here. Ephesians 2:10. For we are who are created in Jesus Christ for good works. Yes, for artistic works. That's right. Yeah. Thank you. Any other suggestions or comments? Now, this is a very important text. This is a very important text as for certain people who have now adopted the name Sophia. And you have Sophia movements all over the world. Those who want to reflect on the fact that not only does God, his earth, as it were, invested with this mysterious code of life, this mysterious blueprint, it's very clear that this mysterious blueprint is portrayed as feminine. And it's the feminine dimension of earth that the code of life. portrayed as this feminine force, this feminine blueprint, and it's very important for women's movements and some feminist movements who are trying to get away from all this masculine language. And while I left this translation his here, we could eliminate the his. But what is important, because, but it's there partly because this is in contrast to the feminine, which is it. Chokhmah and Sophia, both the Hebrew and the Greek, are the feminine expression of wisdom. And wisdom is not simply the accumulation of knowledge. Wisdom is that prior blueprint in creation. That prior code in creation. The soul of earth, I sometimes call it. Okay? Any further comments on that?
What is the Hebrew word for master, craftsman, or child there?
The Hebrew word is amon. And as I said, I think it's only occurs two or three times in the whole Bible. So we've been wildly guessing. The most likely meaning is child, but the translators say that doesn't make any sense to them because they're not very poetic. I think it means child, but I can't prove it. I simply am saying I think this is the better choice of two. That's all. Whereas the case of the way, that is unequivocally there. And they even admit that it's there in your footnote. And that's really a crucial word. So, this is God, the designer, God, the artist, with the designer, the design, the blueprint, which is portrayed as personal. And the interaction is there from the beginning of creation and persists and is still there. All right? What time have I got?
5 to 10.
The last one. I now want to take you to God the Scientist. One of the great passages of the book of Job is Job 28. And Job 28 has this text in it. And I want you to look at it. And I'll write the translation on the board so that it's clear. And it is Job 28, 20 to 26. All right? And it's all about this question of where is wisdom? The whole chapter is about wisdom and how do you get that wisdom. And then comes this last bit from chapter 20 to 28. All right? Wisdom, verse 20. Where does she originate? What is the place of discernment? That's a parallel word to the word for wisdom. God discerned her way. Huh? God discerned her way. You got the same word for way there. The same character, same blueprint. God came to know her place. Now comes the key bit. For God looked to the ends of earth. That's the observation of the wise. That's the scientific process of observation. Looked to the ends of earth, saw everything under heaven or the skies. God fixed the weight of the when God fixed the weight of the wind and meted out the waters by nature, when God made a rule for the rain, that is all the orders and designs and codes of creation, and a way for the thunderstorm, what? Then God discovered her, appraised her, established her, probed her, analyzed her. This is a port of God discovering wisdom. Where? In creation.
So what this translation says, it, you're saying, is feminine wisdom?
Yes. Because if you go back to the beginning of the chapter, it's all about wisdom. Where do you find wisdom? So forth, and so he doesn't repeat the word. Uh-huh. So where does she originate? Where does wisdom originate? What's the place? Then God discovered her way. That is what was truly characteristic of the way, the code behind all the codes. God came to know her place, for God looked, now God has surveys like a good observing scientist, analyzes everything, looks to everything under the sun, not just one bit, everything. He analyzed absolutely everything. Well, God analyzes absolutely everything under creation and in creation, analyzes the lot, and then saw, discovered wisdom. And when he was fixing the weight of the wind, that is those codes, those orders, those rules of nature, the laws of nature, the, meted out the waters by measure, in other words, had that measurement, all these are kind of scientific language. When God made a rule, that is a law for the rain, and a way, that is, which is the characteristic thing of thunderstorms, when God looked at all those ways, and they're all parallels to the word for way, then God discovered the supercode, wisdom, the mystery behind all the mysteries, the design before the design. God here is functioning like a wise of the ancient world, like a scientist, analyzing everything that God can see, and in the process discovers that thing called wisdom, which is not something in his head, not just simply an accumulation of knowledge, it's that master code, that mysterious code in, with, and under the whole of creation, in all the laws of life and everything. It's a wonderful text, a remarkable text, just basically ignore it. But when you want to ask the question about Earth and texts that deal with Earth in a fresh way, this gives you an appreciation that God relates to Earth both as a midwife and as an artist and as a scientist who is analyzing all that's there. It's in the sense God keeps discovering what's there. Fascinating. So, I hope you will go from here with a sense of wonder at the wisdom of creation, the wisdom in creation, the master code, the mystery of it all. I think time's up. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Inside of everything. It drives me up the wall every time I look at it. And I'm standing out there and looking at the mountains and I think, all these thousands of trees and everyone's got thousands of needles and every year is a little different, but oh, it's just a little darker.
Yeah, absolutely. And she goes into the critique of genetic modification of crops, saying that it's very not following
the
wisdom is so...
It's upsetting a lot.
You know, it balances so many things that we can't just start.
We don't know what we're doing if we upset the
elements.
You haven't been in my systems, have you?
No, I haven't. I've been listening.
There's too many other things, I know.
It's like a circus.
I know it is.
I can go to Australia for the bicentenary. I went to one of the.
This gentleman was at the bicentennial.
Yeah, that's where he has one idea. Maybe someone has another idea and it's called
then him.
Yes.
I just.
Well, I should turn it over, shouldn't I?
You say I'm turning it.
No, I could turn it on.
No.